Hi, thanks for joining us on Hometown to Hollywood today. This is Bonnie Wallace, author of The Hollywood Parents Guide. And today my guests on this podcast are television writers and producers John Beck and Ron Hart.
Hey, Bonnie, how you doing?
Hi, Bonnie.
Thrilled to be here.
I am so glad you guys are here with me today. You guys are best known for your work on The Hughleys. Am I pronouncing that right?
You actually hear the G, The Hughleys.
Hughleys, see? Because
yes.
I missed that. I wasn't watching TV when that came out. The Hughleys, and according to Jim, Shake It Up, and Pair of Kings.
Yes.
And you guys are writing partners, and you also serve as creators, executive producers, and showrunners of the award-nominated Disney Channel series, Liv and Maddie. Welcome.
That's right.
So how did you guys get started as writers for TV? Was it something that you always knew you wanted to do?
Yeah, actually. As a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, I was cleaning out the attic of my parents' house and found a book I did in kindergarten. It's called the All About Me book, and there was like, draw a picture of what you think you'll be doing when you're a grown-up, and it was me sitting in a directing chair.
So, no.
Yeah, apparently there was that was in there deep for a long time.
That's so cool.
Isn't that crazy?
I love that. Oh, I can totally see that. Well, what about you, Ron?
No, I don't think I ever pictured myself, it was in high school where I finally pivoted, because I had been doing athletics and stuff, and I did a sketch show on stage, and they the teacher in charge of that kind of encouraged me to keep writing, and I was like, well, if I skip practice, they're gonna kick me off the soccer team. And he was like, you're on the soccer team?
Fairly certain your soccer coach also said that you should consider writing.
So it was it was pretty easy to, once I started doing that, I was on a speech team and I was acting in the show, and I was cast in Of Mice and Men as in the role of boss.
Wow.
And the director was teacher had us she was like, come in with your bio for your character. And the guys playing, George and Lenny, had, a paragraph each. And I had written 12 pages about the guy who had three lines.
Ron's first example of overwriting.
I literally thought about this character more than Steinbeck did. And I was like, okay. So, yeah, I realized – and I still kept, performing, and I tried stand-up and stuff like that. But, I realized very quickly that – I liked to craft the words more than, and I was terrible with the performances. So eventually the writing kind of clicked, and that's where I gravitated. Yeah.
Now you guys met in college, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ron was a senior when I was a freshman at Syracuse.
Oh.
We worked on a student TV show.
Yeah. A student TV station at the time was called UUTV. Now it's called Citrus TV, I think.
It's changed so many names. I don't know which one it's called.
It's either Citrus TV or Hill TV. I think it's Citrus TV now.
That's so cool. So you met there and you were working on the college TV show.
Yeah, and he was very funny as a freshman. We cast him in a couple parts and we're like, hey, he's the funny freshman kid this year. And
we'll let him hang around with us a little bit. Ron was the head writer on the student TV show there, which is called, or the sitcom that they were doing there called Uncle Bobo's World of Fun. About a kid show host that hates kids. Ron also played stagehand number two.
Right.
Well, at the same time, I was running a sketch comedy show called Null and Void, and just kind of gravitated toward each other at, shall we say, extracurricular activities outside of the station. We'll keep it clean.
Keeping it rated G.
Yeah.
It was college.
College has its own very special adventures. Well, so I find that there's a lot of confusion about how the writing process actually works for TV, and I remember specifically when we first got involved with Liv and Maddie being astonished that there were something like a dozen writers for the show. I don't know what I thought. I probably never gave it that much thought, but I always kind of figured, usually you see one or two writers credited for a given episode. Is that normal? So many writers?
A dozen is a little high for what we had here on Liv and Maddie. We had, all told about six, maybe seven entities, but there are several people who were hired as teams. Ron and I are a team. We have two other teams that we also hired on the show. Linda Matthews and Heather McGillivray are a team, and then Danielle Hoover and David Monahan were also a team.
We had nine people who were technically on the writing staff, and then we had Luke Schreiber and Jenny Keene, who were our assistants and probably pitched as many jokes as anyone. So, yeah, that's 11 bodies. Mm-hmm. That is, I think, by today's standards, kind of high. I think usually around 10 is about what your typical writing staff is. It's a little bigger for a multicam show.
When we first got into the business, there was actually, you'd have staffs in the old Carsey Warner days where you'd have maybe 20 writers in a room because they knew Roseanne was going to fire half of them. So you had to just have some bodies around for once Roseanne brought out the fire and hammer.
Yeah, Roseanne and Cosby were kind of famous for having like 20 or 30 writers. And
Roseanne didn't bother to learn the writers' names. It was just, okay, you're writer number 17. What do you got? Nothing. Okay, you're fired. So it seems like a much smaller room than given that perspective. But yeah, there's a lot of people that work on the episode each week. Yes, you do see, you know, two writers credited as the writers for each individual episode, but you have a table full of really funny people that are there to help make each week the best it could possibly be, with fresh jokes and fresh story pitches, and frankly, sometimes getting rid of stuff that isn't working that you thought was going to work. So it's a very collaborative process. It's a little different from when you're first writing a script to try to get it produced as a pilot. You have a very few number of people working on it, and then once if you're lucky enough to get a script that is picked up to be shot as a pilot, then you kind of pull in some favors and put your own staff together as you go throughout the week. And then if you're very fortunate and your pilot gets picked up to series, then you get to have the really cool job of actually hiring people and giving them a paying job for however long the series goes. So we've gotten very fortunate with some really fantastic writers who we were able to stick with us for all four seasons.
Well, we're sitting here in the writer's room right now at a very big table with a lot of chairs around it.
It's very empty now. It's sad.
It is sad and empty now, actually. This is one of my favorite rooms.
Doesn't
generally
smell like takeout quite as much.
There's a lot less cake than there usually has been in this room.
We enjoy our cake on the show. It's true.
Well, how did you guys get involved as creators of Liv and Maddie? How did that happen exactly?
Well, after Syracuse, Ron first moved out to Hollywood, and
we're going back that far.
Yeah, we're going back just to give you some a little bit of a context of how we got to where we were at. Ron came out and was an assistant to agents and managers. I eventually moved out and just said, I got to find that Ron guy. We eventually kind of decided we would be a writing team, and you know, wrote for years with spec scripts and sample scripts, trying to let people know what things would be like if we got our shot to be on staff. We then spent 4 years on the Hughleys, 8 years on According to Jim, and then bounced around after that. Did a season on Shake It Up and kind of got our toes into the Disney Channel world.
Okay, I've heard him tell this story so many times. This is the first time he's tried to keep it G-rated.
all
of the jokes are gone.
So for everybody who's listening out there, I'm at a table with a couple of comedy writers.
Yes.
They are genuinely comedy writers, and they are trying their best to be so good for us.
Trying to behave.
Podcast.
Mom's in the room.
Good job, guys. So far, so good.
So once we got into the Disney Channel world, We had a development deal with them to try to come up with something.
Right.
And the initial pilot that we sold them was...
Well, we got paired with Betsy and Andy, who they had
Andy Pickman and Betsy Solinger, two of our producing partners
show. They have a company, Oops Donuts, and they were working on something with Disney Channel that we were told was like ready to go. And it was about a family where the parents were veterinarians. And I still remember the meeting we had with Andy and Betsy where they started talking about the show where the parents were vets. And, like, I spent half the meeting thinking they were, like, coming back from Iraq. Veterans. And then, like, then they started talking about, like, camels and iguanas. And I was like, oh, veterinarians. And so we're
funny.
Thinking, like...
Of course, we put our producer hats on, and it's like...
Because we just spent a year on Shake It Up where all the kids were minors, and we were just starting to... Because we had done shows with kids, but they weren't the leads. And, like, the Coogan laws of, like, you know, when kids could be on set, like, which, you know, when they're the leads, it starts to, you really have to think about, like, how much you can actually put them in the script. And so we were already thinking that, like, okay, you have a show where the kids are the leads, and now we're going to add donkeys and bats and yes, it's like
and camels and snakes and
like the two things that people say that's
completely unproducible, but they want to do it, right? Great, we're on board. That of course. Once you got into the nuts and bolts of it, you're like, well, that's crazy. We can't possibly do that. What else do you have? What other ideas do you have? And suddenly that turned into an idea about what if Shaq was your uncle and you were living at Shaq's house, and it turns out nobody knew Shaq. So so then we switched that to a bunch of kids living in a mall, and that eventually turned into a...
This is probably like a year and a half of
yeah.
like bouncing ideas off of Disney Channel and you know, who I think they wanted to do something with us, and they really, you know, they were very high on Andy and Betsy, and to their credit, they kept the, you know, it could have easily have died at one of these stages, but the Andy and Betsy really kept the torch burning. And then I think it was the mall thing or the Shaquille O'Neal is your uncle thing that was like, it was like one of those like you know conference calls and Disney Channel's like, so this is the show you want to write, and we're like, and we in that call we mentioned, oh, we had written this thing that was written for adults, and it had come out of our experiences on According to Jim, which was, you know, we were on According to Jim for 7 years, and in that time sitcoms had shrunk from the running time was like something like 24 minutes to 21 minutes
in order to put more commercial time in so they could make some more money. But in that time, we had realized, oh, it shrunk even more from the time when we were kids watching shows. And for, you know, they decided that in order to get rid of, in order to make up the time that you needed to sell the extra commercials, you had to get rid of something. And it was either the stories or it was the funny things that would happen before the story started. Decided
there were funny things in According to Jim that got cut.
Mostly pudding related. But we decided, wouldn't it be fun if you just did a show where you said, let's not worry about the story, let's just do these moments that had been falling away in the editing room floor that you had to cut out to get it to the running time. And once you put all those moments together, you'd kind of get an idea of what it was like each week in an American family. Kind of similar to Reno 911, but instead of police, this was family comedy.
So basically like a series of vignettes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was called Bits and Pieces, and that's when we started casting...
And Disney Channel, like we skipped a part where Disney Channel liked that idea.
So we bid on that.
We wrote, I don't know, 20 drafts of that before they finally said, let's make a pilot, and then we started casting... and that was kind of an incredible thing. I think that was the first time, because we developed a lot of projects, and this is the first time we were getting a pilot shot, and to have actors start saying it out loud, that was
cool.
Shocking. Like, you know, especially when it didn't work.
Wow, gotta get rid of that one. I really thought that was going to work, but 40 people came in here, and it was not funny. So it's been empirically proven that that one did not work.
Only in our minds.
Exactly. that's one of the differences between writing and producing is everything works in your head when you're putting it down, or you wouldn't put it down on the paper. And once you have to start going from getting written words on a page and start getting it on its feet and having actors... read it and having people design it. And once it becomes real life, then you become a producer because it's real easy to have the actors in your head and the set construction people in your head create fantastical stuff. But when you've got this amount of stage time, this amount of budget, and these six actors, it's different.
So you guys were in fact very highly involved in the casting process, and I think that a lot of actors and probably just people in general who are curious about how the industry really works would find that interesting. I think, you know, people know that casting directors cast stuff and they expect that they're going to be in the room, but you guys were super involved, weren't you?
Yeah. Well, we were very fortunate to hire two of the very best casting directors in the business, in Suzanne Goddard-Smythe and Sheila Guthrie. And basically the job of the casting director is to find a ton of really talented actors that they are fans of, and then they bring in, I mean, we saw hundreds of people for these roles.
And it was like black magic, because it was like, how are there that many funny kids out there? And I just, you know, because for the final gag reel, the editor asked to find the audition tapes from the, you know, the pilot. And I went through like a million emails from like when we were casting the pilot, and it was just... I cannot get over the amount of work that
Sheila and Suzanne put into it. And then, like, looking at the list, I mean, obviously I know the people that we cast, but, like, the list of people that came in and read for our pilot that are all, like, on shows now.
Major stars somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, they're all, the Just Jared crowd is, they were all in to read for it, and they, you know, you could see, I think, you know, you see when there's, like, potential that some, you know, some cases it's not quite there yet, and some cases it's like, oh my god, this kid is going to be is ready to go. And I, you know, I mean, I think obviously with Dove, that was like, oh, who's this? And you know, and that was someone she apparently saw in like a high school.
Yeah, Dove didn't realize that till midway through season two. Is that one of our casting directors went to the high school choral concert at Burbank High School?
Mm-hmm. And was the like, show oh, this, choir concert.
Yeah, the show choir. It's like, oh, this Dove Cameron is really good. We should bring her in to read.
That happens, and kids should know that. Of course, it happens more in New York and L.A., but,
sure.
but you don't know where people might see you.
And we really saw such a huge difference, and I totally credit Sheila and Suzanne with this, between self-tapes and sessions with the CDs, and it was like just night and day in terms of the energy. And I think really, like, you know, because Sheila and Suzanne talked to us a lot about one of the very lucky things about Bits and Pieces, and this was not by design, but because of what we talked about, it was this fragmented story, and it gave every character moments to shine, and it ended up being perfect for sides. And apparently Disney Channel still uses it as like sort of a general casting call. Like,
because I didn't know that.
The material is just like, it's all kind of like individually tailored. And so it's, you know, I think, in a lot of ways, we were fortunate in that, and they were able to use that material to really like kind of find the right voice for kids. And we actually, when we read Joey Bragg, it was like, did we make this kid up?
We dreamed it up
because it was like almost exactly the character we had written, and it was kind of eerie. So,
and that works sometimes. Other times, you know, a good producer will identify talented kids and tailor what they've written to fit that person.
Well, you guys changed the role of Parker quite a lot, right?
Parker wasn't Parker. He was Brody.
That's right. Yeah. He was Brody, and he was a completely different character.
He was. He was younger. He was really funny, but...
And I would say that was a Disney Channel thing. They were like, that kid is hilarious, but you've written a part for a kid much younger than him, so... Because he was...
He's too smart for this character.
He was basically an idiot to be that old and that wild.
So originally, like, Parker's character was a kid who was positive that eventually his superpowers were going to kick in once he got a little bit older and was throwing himself against the wall, trying to stick like Spider-Man. And Tenzing was hilarious with it, but it was like, okay, who damaged you? What what is wrong with you, man?
You're a hair too old.
You're 10, not 5.
So they fell in love with the actor and changed the character to fit the actor.
Yeah. They saw like a spark there, and they were like, you know, let's age that up, but this is the kid. The other thing was we had two leads. We'll come back to that in a moment. But there were two girls, and we saw a lot of girls read for both parts. You know, one was Alana, who Dove ended up playing, and the other one was
Crystal,
who was played by Cozy Zulsdorf. And they were very different characters. There were definitely echoes of Liv and Maddie in them. They weren't exactly those characters, but... to see, that was really eye-opening, because there were some girls that could do both, and there were other girls where it's like, oh, you're clearly an Alana, or you're a Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another great like way of like getting to know the actors. And I think by the time we shot the pilot, again, not by design, but it ended up being this fantastic camera test where we really understood what our ensemble was like capable of and where they could really shine.
By the end of things, they take a look at this and they're like, wow, this is... And it came out really good. But the format was so different that... The thing about children's television is you really have kind of one shot of making this group work, or else, you know, if you don't make that pilot work at that time, suddenly your entire cast is a year or two older, and they start to no longer be the kids that you want on the Disney wants on their network. And they saw the pilot, and especially saw Dove pop off the screen. And
yeah, we didn't get all the testing numbers, but clearly, whatever numbers they got on Dove were off the chart.
They said, we think she could be the next face of the network. We were a little leery about trying this, putting her in a format that we're not 100% sure how to sell. So we kind of snipped around and tried to figure out what kind of things they were wanting to do format-wise, and we...
This is after 2 years of developing four different versions of it.
I love hearing this because people have no idea how much sweat and blood and love and time goes into just
and
getting
cake.
Something.
Don't
and
forget
cake goes into getting something on the air.
I think this was... I want to say this was a unique thing because I do think now Disney Channel does do this more often because of what John's talking about. Like, you really, like, once you identify the talent, there is like a limited window for them to get it on the air. So I think they're more inclined to kind of keep the ensembles together and then reinvent the wheel, so to speak. But I think because, like, we had been on Shake It Up and Pair of Kings, and we had done these three or four different incarnations before it was even Bits and Pieces, I think we were aware of, like, sort of what they were looking for in a series. And we had heard, like, the idea of, like, Patty Duke.
The rumor we had heard was that the head of the network was a huge fan of the Patty Duke show and had always wanted to do the Patty Duke show. And we said, hey, why don't we do the Patty Duke show and see if somebody kind of bites on it? And they did. Turns out our intel was good. And
remember this moment. We were talking to Disney Channel with Andy and Betsy, Andy Fickman and Betsy Solinger once again. And the head of Disney Channel said, do you think Dove Cameron can pull this off? And we had just come in to pitch it. And the two of us looked at each other like, and Andy Fickman in the corner was like, absolutely
she can.
And to this day, I don't know if he had that much faith in her, or if it was just like, I'm selling this thing today. We're getting this on the air. Because of course that's the answer. Like, of course you say yes, and you find out.
That's one of the things we've actually learned as showrunners, is never let them see you think.
Right.
Agree, go back and think, and then if you get, now that we thought about it, maybe this. But in that moment, absolutely fantastic.
The answer is always yes.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was until we did, and by now, we did like 5 or 6 drafts of the new pilot for the twin show that eventually became Liv and Maddie, and then we had a writing staff, and we probably had like 6 scripts written, and it wasn't until the first table read where we knew if it was going to be a show, because it was literally like about whether we could buy that this girl was going to play 2 characters.
Well, this is either going to work or we're going to be fired by lunchtime, so let's see what happens.
And then it was, it was like a lightning bolt. Like, everybody got it in that room immediately. Like, this is going to work. It's going to be dynamite. And then this is another part of the writing process. Then once you get into series, then you start to understand better what is working in terms of the characters, in terms of the relationships, in terms of, like,
who works well together, who doesn't necessarily work well together.
Mm-hmm. Where's the chemistry really strong?
Exactly. What do you need to bring in that's not necessarily in this group of regulars that you've been living with for the last, 6 months.
Like, right. That was the next thing. Was like, we'd spent all this time, like, coming up with the pilot and the family and, like, creating this world. And then once it's like getting ready to go, Disney's like, all right, now who are the friends?
Who else is there? What?
Yeah. Who are the recurring guest stars?
Right.
And that's another thing. Like, and how involved were you guys in casting guest stars?
Every session.
Yeah.
Wow.
Again,
that's
like
huge.
Sheila and Suzanne just doing fantastic.
They bring you great
work.
Choices and then you sit and have them audition sometimes. And again, some people come in and just connect with the material that you've written and it's lights out. And then some people are like, for example, Jessica Marie Garcia, who plays Willow, she not only did she connect with the material with Willow, whose name was actually Princess at the time, she's pleased to say, like, I always wanted to be a Disney princess, and for about a week I was, until they changed it to Willow. But she came in, we actually not only had stuff from actual episodes in the rehearsal material, but we had written a scene that was not supposed to be part of the show at all.
Right,
just a sample scene to have people audition with. Where there's a 2.5-3 page scene where we find that she's got a crush on Joey and is not going to let him wriggle out of it. And she came in and crushed it so much in that sample scene that we added that into episode 2 as the tag for the episode, and it became a major storyline for us for 4 seasons.
This is something I learned there too. Was you see these actors in the room. But they're also, at least our process was we were videotaping them as well. And there is like a difference watching it on tape after. When you're in the room, there's like, that live vibe. And I don't think this is a secret. Like, Miranda May also read for that part. And I remember in the room thinking, these two girls are hilarious, and I couldn't separate them. And there was just something about, and I know exactly what it was. When I watched the video, my wife started laughing in the other room at Jessica. Like, she wasn't even watching it. And she was like, who's that girl?
Just half yeah. listening, she found her hilarious.
And Miranda was hilarious, too. But it was just like, it was clearly like, all right, this girl's right for this part. We're going to find something else.
And yeah, as producers, we always remember somebody who we're going to bring in for something else. And we eventually got Miranda in to play Lacey.
I love that you brought this up. And I'd love to circle it back around to the original casting process. Because you mentioned that looking back at the original tapes for the pilot.
Yes.
That there were a lot of actors that now you can say are, you know, household names, they're well known, they're sure. on their own shows, they're doing movies. And I think it's really cool and important for young actors to hear this because, you know, you may get really close, you may get into callbacks over and over again and be beating yourself up because you're not getting the roles, but that doesn't mean you're not going to get the roles like the next week or month.
Yeah.
Well, you know? we always tell people, don't be like, not everybody is right for every part, and that's tough to hear as any actor, but especially as a kid actor, because you suddenly feel like you've gone in, and if you didn't get the part, you failed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so not the case. That a lot of times it's like, go in and have fun in that audition. You're getting to do something that 99.9% of the people out there who would love to be doing aren't able to do. So going in and having fun in the audition and not stressing out about it should be a really enjoyable experience. Number one, you got a shot at getting a part. Number two, you know, even if you don't get the part, you're getting in front of people who are going to be looking for other things at some point.
And who yeah. will remember you. And who will be able to say, you know, hey, you've got talent, you're wonderful, you're amazing, you're just not right for this role at this time.
Yes.
That's okay.
Yeah. Or someone else is just a little more right. Sometimes you mm-hmm. are fantastic and you're the, you know, second or third choice, and that's still pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it can feel binary for an actor. I'm imagining that, like, okay, I got a callback, I didn't get a callback, I got the part, I didn't get the part, but there's a lot more nuance to it than that.
And it's about growing your arsenal of weapons you can use when you go into audition for the next role. And frankly, when you eventually get on, when you do get cast on something, you're a little more seasoned and a little more polished. There are people who, yes, go in for their very first audition and book a part, and, you know, it happens very quickly. But many times when those kids get on set, and just the way sitcoms work, sometimes things change very drastically in a rewrite from one night to another, and they've only prepared for what they have already been handed in front of them, and they're not able to use the skills that you need to be able to move from one role to the next, even within the context of the part that you've booked in that episode, because they don't have the seasoning and experience to kind of roll with it.
That's huge. I'm so happy you brought that up because a lot of kids, like, the process that you have to go through, the vetting process almost, that you have to go through with all those auditions and all that work to just try and get something, is part of what prepares you to succeed once you finally do get it.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. And I think one thing that I think Andy Fickman taught us this, it's a trick that, like, if we really like someone, we will ask them to do the scene again and, like, just give them a note that doesn't make, it might not even make sense, but it's literally just to see if they can change up what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that's, I think, the difference between, like, acting and versus, like, just kind of having this, like, you know, locked in audition performance. And I think, especially I think with younger actors, that is a tendency of, like, you get overcoached and you start to lose, like, the humanity of the character, which is deadly on a set, because at the end of the day, you're not, like, the audition process is not what you're doing, because it's just
what you're auditioning for. Yeah. May show up in the table draft that you read on Monday, but it may be drastically different from what you actually shoot on Friday.
Well, you guys, I have seen this, you know, the script changes every single day.
Yeah.
And even sometimes, well, frequently, right there as you're filming. Lines fall out, lines get added.
Yeah.
Not just kids, but actors can't get flustered by that. They have to roll with it.
That's a lot of trust. That's they have to trust, your actors have to trust your writers and producers that we have your best interest in mind, and we'll make you look Well, make sure you're presented in the best possible light, and your producers also have to trust the actors that they'll be able to handle some changes if the changes are necessary, or sometimes trust that if we give you another shot on something, that it's that when to give you another day on something if it's not necessarily working. It's kind of a two-way street. We're very performance-based producers and like to make sure that our actors are also bringing something to the process and not just parroting back the words that we wrote in the way that we wrote them.
That was something we really learned. The first show that we were on staff was The Hughleys with D.L. Hughley, who's a...
Love that guy.
He was a great first boss, and he's a stand-up. He's not an actor by nature. He's a good actor. But he's, you know, that's where he came from, was stand-up. And what he said to us in our first season was like, when you go to the airport, no one says, oh, there's the writer from The Hughleys. When I go to the airport, there's going to be a guy who comes up to me and says, you said this in this scene, and then DL used some words that we're not going to use.
But this is a G-rated
podcast.
This
joke you wrote on page 10, yes, it is very funny. It is not very funny for me in this context.
And it,
so it's about learning.
It's yeah, that your actors have to be able to feel authentic. And I think that's the difference between like a play and a movie and like a TV show. The characters, the actors have to live with them. And I think if it does it, I don't think you can, like, it can't be fake from beginning to end. And yes, Dove is playing Liv and she's playing Maddie, but there's part of Dove in both of those characters. And I think if the actor can't tap into that, it's going to
It's not the actor's fault in television. It's the producer and writer's fault for not making sure they're feeling comfortable in front of that camera and put in a position to do what they do best. We've had some characters that we've cast somebody and their character is sarcastic and it's just kind of not playing right because we realize, oh, this actor, yes, can play sarcastic, but that's not naturally what they're best at. They're best at being bright, sunny, happy, and fun. Change it around. Find a way to do this exact storyline with this exact same moves, but with a different point of view from this character. And that's kind of always where we approach things from, is finding what somebody does well and put them in a position to do that. Because we've always said that you can always tell a show where people are enjoying what they're doing because it just feels like it's fun. And I can't tell you, it's fun to watch, it's fun to, because there's a lightness and an enjoyment. And I can't tell you what the difference is between a show where I know that they're not enjoying themselves, but you can tell.
You can feel it. Well, one thing I noticed that I just thought was super cool was near the end of season one, something very subtle shifted, and it was very clear to me that the writers were really writing for the actors.
Yeah.
And that only accelerated and continued all throughout all four seasons, whereas, I mean, every season, in my eyes, has gotten better and better, in part just because you guys know the actors so intimately as people, know where their strengths are, and to be able to write for the actors that you know so intimately, that's got to be kind of amazing, but it also makes for an incredibly great show.
It's cool. In fairness, part of that is also our network realizing kind of who everybody was and what was working. And
I would say the first half of the season we wrote for Disney Channel because they had... And I don't mean that as a...
No, we were developing on the air. We had no pilot.
They're very controlling, but they also, like, they know what their brand is, mm-hmm. and they know, like, they've done it so many more times than we have, so they know what works and what doesn't, and they were really pushing us to make it different and interesting. And I think at a certain point, once the gears started like clicking, it you know, then they kind of loosened the reins a little bit. And I think what you're talking about is also a credit to our writing staff of like having a good ear and
hearing people's voices, hearing how people talk, knowing, oh yes, this is exactly what this character would do in this situation. We know that because we've seen 10 episodes of this character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's tough to do in episode 2, number one, because you don't necessarily know what that character would do in that situation because you haven't seen that situation. And you also don't really know the strengths of that actor yet. Joey Bragg had drastically different rhythms than many other characters and actors that have been on this network before. And not only do you have to train, you know, this 15-year-old kid how to do the job of a sitcom actor. Joey came from, he was a teenage stand-up, literally from 12 years old on. So
that's amazing,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, he's, yeah. So he was learning how to do multi, as was everybody on the staff, but you also had to train a network into expecting a different kind of rhythm out of somebody than they than they're used to for the actors that they've had on their network for the last decade. So it takes a little bit, you know, and you've got to kind of give and take on both sides and make sure everybody is happy at the end of things.
Yeah, and grow and evolve together. Now, so you guys are directors. You're show creators is what I meant to say,
right.
and producers and writers. I've also, you know, the word showrunner shows up when you guys are talked about around the show. What exactly is a showrunner, and what do you do as a showrunner? Is that just a term that just kind of encompasses all those other things?
The first 6 weeks, we kept saying, we're not showrunners, we're show superintendents.
We're show walkers.
I would,
unless there's cake.
That's true, then we'll run.
I would say this, like, because we were executive producers on According to Jim for 4 or 5 seasons, I don't remember. At a certain point on that show, we became executive producers, which is different than being a showrunner. And there were lots of aspects of According to Jim that we got to manage, but we weren't the boss of bosses or whatever you want to call it. To me, the biggest difference when we became quote-unquote
the showrunner is basically the person who's got to hold the wheel at the ship and steer and make sure everything is
The thing that I noticed was we had to say no a lot. And it wasn't that like something I'd never expected, but it was like we hired these writers who are really funny. We hired these actors who are really funny, these directors who are really creative. And like they all have ideas, and having to go no a lot, like every day say no. That we're
used to being the jerks in the back of the room that throw 20
right.
things at the wall and see what sticks.
Mm. Yeah.
Once you're the showrunner, you're the person making, if not making every decision, actually, very, very rarely are we making every decision, but we're approving every decision or saying yes this, no to that. And having to learn how to do that without stepping on toes was a tough thing to learn.
So not making every decision. I don't even know.
Exactly.
But I think the thing, like going back to what John said a couple minutes ago about like you want people to be having fun. Because again, part of it is like, yeah, you want to have fun at your job. But the other part is producer, you want your show to be fun to watch. And we think that that is the best way for a show to be entertaining and like feel like a party, as if there is really a party going on.
Everybody's invested.
So to have that happen, you have to be cognizant of like when people feel invested in the show. You want people to feel invested. And I think we were very fortunate in getting people who were really like emotionally invested in the stories and where the comedy was coming from. And then, you know, when they have like strong ideas and you say no, like 4 times in a day, that's going to get to you. And like, again, like John was saying, like we were those guys and, you know, we heard no quite a bit. And there's times where you sort of like go off in a corner, you lick your wounds, and then you come back and you do it all over again. So, and I'm not trying to say that like we're, you know, the stern disciplinarians, but it was, that was the thing that was the most unexpected to me about becoming the showrunner was I imagine it as being like the, like, oh, look at how much fun it is to be in charge. And there was certainly some fun.
We had our fun.
But like, for example, we would, you know, every now and then take a break in the writer's room, and the writers had this ritual where they would go for a lot walk, where they're just basically like they'd go out for a walk for 10 minutes and walk around the lot. And there was one day where I was like, oh, I'm not doing anything. I'm going to come with you guys. They're like, great. And it was like silent. I was like, oh, this is when they complain about
this
me.
They complain about my walk.
They need this. I can't be here for this.
That's hilarious.
I got to go away. Yeah. So that was,
Well, so it sounds like the showrunner is primarily the bad cop and also sometimes the good cop. Is it sort of like that?
The showrunner is the bus driver.
Okay.
And sometimes you're steering, sometimes you're pushing the gas pedal, sometimes you're opening the door, sometimes you're
yelling at the kids in the back, and sometimes you're putting on the brakes.
Exactly.
I think
But in order to keep the machine moving, you know, you've got to be thinking six steps ahead while still doing six steps behind in post. And it's about kind of just being the ringmaster and keeping the circus going, as long as they'll let you keep the circus going.
And I think there's like a romanticized version in Hollywood of like the auteur theory of like that a showrunner has a vision for a show. And I'm sure like
some people do it that way.
Shem Ishmael and Aaron Sorkin, people like that. I think Joss Whedon, when he had like ran a show, was like this a little bit where it's like they have a vision and that this is what it's going to be. But I think for us, it was like more about like, okay, we want to make a show that's funny. We have this team and, you know, we've assembled this team and like, it's trying to find like the parts of the team that are going to make the show as great as it can be. And I mean, when we started production of Living Maddie, I had no idea it was going to be what it ended up being. And it was a great ride and I'm, you know, but the idea that we created it, I think is like great for our royalty payments, but like,
it's fun.
Yeah.
It was right, co-creation. Yeah. It was a co-creation.
Yeah. I think,
for sure.
I think television has to be collaborative. So yeah, that was,
but we've also, you know, developed a nice feel for what will work story-wise, what will work. Like, this actor will tap into this. This is the kind of joke that they'll tap into. Just having a good feeling for what people are going to need in order to do what they do.
Oh, yeah, that was, I mean, that's actually a good point, is, like, in the middle of that first season, just realizing we were grinding Dove into dust, basically, because it was like, she's playing two characters, and she's in, like, every scene, and like, so many episodes, and, like, just realizing, like, we needed to find ways for her to not be in every moment of the scene.
Which also, you know, that wasn't and just then, protecting Dove. That was growing
right.
our show in different directions.
Yeah, because then by the Tenzing time we had blossomed the, and Joey yeah. blossomed and we found these guest casts that were
by the
amazing.
End of season three, we had an entire storyline involving three guest characters with Dump Truck and Andy and Eric Estrada as her dad. And Mom was kind of there, but it was like, oh, wow, right. like... None of these people are series regulars, but there's an entire very touching, very poignant, emotional storyline going on with our version of The Simpsons Springfield with all our crazy guest characters that we married off two other characters. It was kind of the emotional pinnacle of season three with Johnny right. Nimbus and Gemma. So it's...
Right. Like, who are they?
Like, yeah, that's pretty fabulous.
Ask us at the pilot who Johnny Nimbus and... Gemma are, and you're like, what?
Well, you know, Johnny Nimbus is a fabulous example of something that can happen with a guest star when yes. they just are so powerful and capture the imagination of everybody around them that you just keep looking for excuses to write them into new episodes,
right?
That was
literally the case. They were literally like, just let's find an excuse to use them. And I
same thing with Shaq, who played Dump Truck. He yeah. was initially supposed to be in one episode, had about seven words, and his audition was... Like, I literally saw him sitting on a bench as we walked in, and it's like 100-degree heat. He's got a leather jacket on, his socks, or his pants tucked into his socks. I'm like, if this guy can utter a word, he's got this job. And then he came in, and he's really funny. I came back through him, like, write more jokes for Dump Truck. He's going to be funny this week.
Yeah.
And then he was so good that week, he's like, find any possible way you can get this guy into the show. And he ended up, I think, doing... 10, 12 episodes for us, all said and done, after literally supposed to be in for a week.
Yeah. I love that.
I mean, Kurt was supposed to be, that was just for that episode.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the episode was, like, Liv gets, you know, her boyfriend breaks up with her. And I think at the time, I think we thought that the boyfriend was someone who might come back again. And that, you know.
And he was good, too.
He was really good.
Boy, Johnny Nimbus stole that show.
Yeah.
Suddenly he's...
Right, it was
hosting
like,
Christmas pageants, and we never actually did have him do the weather, but...
any reason to have him, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It's like, if you do get that opportunity just to, like... there's a... When you have your moment to shine, if you...
Take it!
If you can hit it, yeah, it really does... I think normally producers do take note of that, like someone who really just knocks it out of the park.
Well, and then conversely, you know, for all those actors out there who get an opportunity to be a guest star and then that's it, it's the one-off. I mean, that right. is the norm.
Yes.
And that's got everything to do with storylines and probably nothing to do with your talents as an actor. You know, most guest stars are designed to be there just once.
Yeah.
And sometimes Miller White was a perfect example of somebody who was really fantastic in our third episode, what's his name? Connor Weil was the actor's name.
Yeah.
He was in our third episode. Loved him. Tried to figure out how to bring him back in later on, and there just wasn't an opportunity to bring in that ex-boyfriend again. And by that point, you know, he's somebody we would have loved to have brought in for some of the other parts that did... There were designed to do more episodes, but we'd already used him. So mm-hmm, sometimes mm-hmm. not getting... Actually, Lauren Donzis, who came in to play... who will be a series regular in season four with his cousin Ruby, she actually auditioned for us early on, and we couldn't cast her for that episode because there was some scheduling conflict. It was one of the porcupines in the backyard. But had we been able to cast her there, she wouldn't have been a series regular for us season four. We just remembered who she was, and when she came in again, we were predisposed to knowing she was going to be fantastic.
That's a great thing to point out. And you've actually had several people who've been recurring guest stars mm-hmm. that then there were the people who were second or third, you know, choices they came really close to,
oh, yeah.
who then, in fact, were cast later as other characters.
Mm-hmm. There was a couple of times in the first season where we wrote guest cast and we were really happy with them. And there's one in particular I can think of, I'm not going to name, who did a sensational job. And it was our fault because the character in the court, because we enjoyed the character so much, got so cartoony that the network is like, this isn't tonally your show. Like, this is a different universe and this character is sticking out like a sore thumb. And we weren't able to bring that character back, which broke our hearts because it was like, oh, you know, we knew that we had someone really good there. And that was like our failure as the writers and the producers of not sensing when it had kind of crossed the line and become like a caricature of like what the character had originally been. And that's a fine line to, you know, because it is like, you know, it's a broad comedy. There's definitely, I mean, look, no one is saying Johnny Nimbus is a grounded organic character.
How dare you?
You know, but there is something about, you know, there is a line, and once you go past it, it's hard to bring it back. So that's another thing. Like that, the actor did a fantastic job. You know, that had nothing to do with what they brought to the role. That was entirely about how we had managed it. So that, I mean, that's something that, like, how do you tell an actor that? Well, you know, it's not your fault.
Basically, what we're saying is a lot of times we're awful.
Yeah.
Well, basically, what I'm hearing is that there's. And in my experience, frankly, at this point, bears this out. There's so much going on behind the scenes
yes.
that affects what anybody sees from a show or from a movie or whatever. And what anybody sees in the final product is a tiny slice of the tip of the iceberg. And the story is where the bottom of the iceberg is, you know. And you can't know what right. went on behind the scenes that explains why this person never came back and this person came back for 15 episodes. Or, you know, why this person's role grew and doubled and why this one's disappeared. It's like there's just stuff that you can't know about. And that's why the actors can't take it personally, really.
Right. Well, enjoy your time with what you're doing. Whether it is auditioning, whether it is... your 1 week that you're there and part of whatever family you're part of, or whether you're there for, I mean, Jessica Marie Garcia did, I think, 35 episodes all told for us, and, you know, was as much a series regular as you could possibly have without being in the main titles. But, you know, just enjoy what you're doing when you get the opportunity to do it, because these opportunities are a special thing that not everybody gets a chance to do.
They are special. What do you find are some of the most challenging things about producing a TV show, and what's some of the most fun about producing a TV show?
One of the most fun things I can say is...
New heat take fun.
Or best
now,
things.
Now I got to do challenges.
But now you can
best,
think about challenges.
Best, whatever. What do you love?
One
what
of the most fun
hard?
Things is figuring out how to make somebody shine who is struggling. Whether that is in an audition, agents yell at us all the time for taking too much time with each kid who comes into audition. Especially, they don't mind if they're kids at the front of the line, but if they have to wait an extra hour because we'll take kids. And if a kid comes into audition for us, they're going to leave with a positive experience. Whether we do six takes or not, and we know somebody isn't necessarily even right for the role, they're going to leave having learned something about the process in that audition.
Or at least you think of a lollipop.
Or they're certainly getting candy at the end of that. So find, even if it's a kid that didn't necessarily get the part, finding a way to make that kid feel great about that process is one of the things I love most. Occasionally we'll cast somebody on the show who things change on and they get a little lost, and just finding a way to help them find their way back into what is working for them is also incredibly satisfying.
Challenging things?
Well, I think the most challenging thing about TV is there's two limitations that you always have to deal with. One is time. Like, you have a certain running time, and you can't go over it. And Disney Channel is actually, there's a flexibility in terms of what we turn in editing. Like, we have a little bit of wiggle room. Like, on a network TV show, it is, like, to the second. And I think on the, you know, the premium cable, there's a little more flexibility. But even then, it's still, like, you know, you can't spend 14 minutes on the A scene, even though these two characters are hilarious and like they're back and forth, like you could linger there. And if this was a play, you would. If it was a movie, you'd watch, you know, four or five scenes of this, but you have to keep that story moving. And that's always the hardest thing in terms of the production week, of figuring out what things to take out. Cause it's never like, oh, we have to add scenes. It's always us taking scenes away. And moments that are like, frankly, you know, really great, but it's just, we don't have room for it. The other thing is the budget, because we're not paying for it. Someone else is. And so there's limits in terms of like how many sets you can have, how many actors you can have each week. That's a big deal. If there's going to be music, how much music you can have. And then at the end of the day, it's about the length of your day. It's about how much time you have on stage and looking at each scene and like doing, okay, we've done three takes of this. I want one more, but we have this big scene coming up and I'm going to want 20 takes of that. And like, so like those are like the things that you have to kind of like manage. And I guess that's part of being going back to what a showrunner does, is like trying to make these determinations of like how you're spending your time, how you're spending your money. And those are the biggest limitations that you get put.
I would also add one of the cool things, but incredibly challenging things about this business is it's completely subjective. You could have 700 people in a room and they all have a different opinion on something, and all of them are right. There's no right or wrong in this business. It's about, okay, what are we going to do next?
Mm-hmm. There was a writer, Yonetta Boone, who taught us that.
Baby, sometimes you could be right and wrong at the same time.
And it's so true.
Also, never fart in the writer's room. Right. Two great pieces of advice.
Disney Channel uses that word. We can use that word.
But again, that's part of the job as a showrunner. It's like, okay, you've got 10 different people in the room and they all have a different opinion. Which one are you picking and which way are you rowing? And then getting everybody to get on board with that, in that direction, is kind of your job as a showrunner. It's like, okay. Now, the cool thing about multicam is you can go in one direction and try it for a day. And if it doesn't work, you'll see it the next day at run through. And, you know, a good producer, a good showrunner will be able to admit, okay, we tried it that way. My idea did not work. What do we want to try today?
This is while you're still rehearsing.
While you're still rehearsing and getting ready to shoot.
Yeah.
But it can be challenging, and it changes. Because when you're in production, it's, okay, what are we going to have? We've got, you know, these six sets, these 10 actors. Here's what we're going to do tomorrow. When you're developing and still trying to get something on the air, it's a completely different set of rules, because it's no longer what are we going to do? It's what could we do? What are all the things we could do? It's just kind of pretend at that point, and your scripts are basically sales pieces to get somebody to sign on before you actually have to do it, and suddenly everything has to change because you can't, you know, have scene one be exterior moon. You pull back, reveal right. Space. At least not in a multicam sitcom, but
not on that budget.
But, yeah.
Well, so now that Liv and Maddie's wrapped filming its fourth and sadly final season, and you guys have shot 80 episodes,
yeah.
Any advice for young actors whose dream it is to be on the Disney Channel? What would you tell a kid out there who wants to be part of something that you've done?
Smile and enjoy yourself. When you go into audition, know that just walking into an audition should be a fantastic experience for you. Not everybody necessarily... When you have 100 kids coming into audition and you're only casting one person, 99 people are going to walk away having not gotten that role. But remember, the auditioning is the job. That is the fun. That is part of the process. And just find out what you enjoy about acting in this process and bring that to your audition. Because then you're going to be having fun regardless.
I would say, I think kind of the other side of the coin is like, don't do this unless you need to do it, because it is hard and it's there. You know, it can be fun, but it is like you've alluded to, there can be a lot of rejection. So I don't think you can make it unless you have a passion to do it. You have to really need to do it from your soul, and not because you want to be famous or you want to, you know, your friends to see you on TV. It has to be that you love acting, that you love performing, because that's the only way that, like what John is saying, could be like, you're not going to have fun auditioning unless you love acting. You know, you're not going to have fun figuring out how to read these sides in a way that's going to make the casting director respond unless you really want to be a performer. And I think, you know, you can't get into it because you want more Instagram followers. It has to be that you are committed to really performing and just to learning the craft, because it is a job. And I think the biggest mistake is and we've met these kids, and it looks like it's easy, and it is not. It is really hard work, and there's a lot of like really like great benefits to it. And I hope that the kids that we've worked with have had a great experience, but we ask a lot of them, because it's at the end of the day, it's a multi-million-dollar production that is. The cameras are pointed at them, you know, we really, you know, when the lights come on, we really need them to hit it. And so you've got to be the person who wants to be in that position, not to be the person who's on the red carpet 6 months later, but who is like in the studio at 6 a.m. getting makeup so that they can have a pie thrown in their face in an hour. And then if it misses their face, they're going to be back in makeup and do it again. Like that's the grind of being an actor. And I think you really, really have to want that.
The other thing I would suggest, if you really want to make it in this business, see if you can talk Pam Fisher into representing you. Somehow, she represented like 90% of the people we hired on this show. So
Pam Fisher.
If you can get Pam to represent you, smooth sailing from there.
I know. She's the magic agent. Well, now, finally, any advice for young writers?
Finally? We're done?
Well, we're nearing the end of our time together. We all know that we could talk all day together.
Yes.
But you know, young writers who are out there who want to break into screenwriting for film or TV. So if I were a 22-year-old and I just finished college and I wanted to move out to LA or New York to try and break into screenwriting for film or TV and make a living as a writer, what would you tell me?
Do it. Can't happen.
Don't take my job.
What advice would you have?
No, 22-year-old Bonnie Wallace? Can you imagine? I can't compete with that.
I could have been a contender.
Biggest thing to tell young writers, and this is going to sound like the dumbest thing ever, but trust me, it is...
Yep. The thing they all forget.
Writers write.
Yep.
People will tell you over and over again, it's all about being in the right place at the right time in this business. While that is technically true, I like to say it's more about putting yourself in a position to take advantage of an opportunity when it presents itself. And if you're not writing scripts, you're not a writer. You're just somebody who's kind of around. Because eventually someone's going to say, oh, you're a writer, I'd love to read something you've written. And if you don't have a script to hand them that day or email them that day, you've lost out on that opportunity. They don't want to hear, oh, well, I've been working on this thing and I could probably get you something in like 3 or 4 weeks. Blah, 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 blah. Writers are always writing.
Yeah, and I think that certainly that is still true, but that is sort of coming from like when we broke in the 90s, you want to be able to hand them the script. I think that's still the case. You got to write scripts, but I do think that it's a different world now and you can create your own content what maybe it's a podcast or maybe it's a YouTube video, something that shows like you can create narrative. I think that is probably the new way to brand yourself, and don't be afraid to put yourself out there. When we were breaking into the business, people strongly discouraged writers from creating original content. It was about, you know, write your spec version of Seinfeld or Roseanne or Home Improvement. This is how old we are. Friends. Oh, it's Friends. There was probably such a saturation that it was hard to distinguish, like, okay, I've read 20 Friends specs today. I don't know which one is the good one. So then now people, I think, are more inclined to read a pilot idea. In theory, that's showing the voice of the writer.
Well, agents also don't want to sign somebody unless they can create an original show, because they want to sign an ex-show creator, because that's, you know, better business for them to be in the long run than somebody who would be a great story editor.
A young writer should think of pilot ideas and like what they want to write, what they're passionate about, what they think they can transmit. But I would say you better know how to write an episode of a show too, because writing a pilot is a very different thing, because there's a lot of
watch TV, a lot listen of listen to TV,
right? Like when you write a pilot, you're introducing the characters and the world, and there's a lot of like real estate given to that. But when you write episode, you know, 4 of Modern Family, that's just story. Like that's like, okay, we know who these characters are, we know what their house looks like. Now it's like, let's tell the story of like when these two characters do X. And so I think even if, you know, you're not, if you're writing your pilot and you're making a YouTube video, you better know how to write a script for a show, because if you get a break as a writer, more than likely it's not going to be on a show you created. Your first show is going to be, you know, something that is already up and running, or it's a new show and they're looking for a young staff writer. And if you get that shot, you don't want to be, the showrunner doesn't want to hear the kid at the end of the table telling them how their show should be. They want the kid who's like got a funny joke, or, oh, I have this idea for a story, or
you're there to say yes and here's another joke. No, right. Nah, I don't think that'll work, boss.
Exactly. Because that's how you get fired, frankly.
So, and you guys both were assistants when you first hit town, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's a really normal way for writers to get started.
Well, that is the other thing, and this experience is going to sound really dumb, is if you want to be writing in television in the entertainment business, you got to move to Los Angeles. That's where this happens.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not here, it's like going fishing in the desert. You're just not going to catch anything. And you're doing all the same things that you would possibly be doing, but there's just not any fish there. So you move to town, you get yourself, if you want to work in television, you know, there's your job and there's your career. And your job is going to be being an assistant and starting to make relationships with the people who eventually are going to read your scripts, which you're going to be writing at night. And on the weekends, when you're done with your job, that's when your career starts and your career is writing.
And that's hard. I mean, if you're a PA on a TV show...
I mean, Ron and I get together at 2 in the morning when we were both assistants afterwards to be working on our scripts outside of things.
I mean, a 12-hour day is like your normal day. I mean, and then to then say, oh, but I have to go write a script, or I'm going to make a video on the weekend, it's hard for sure. So, again, I think going back to that passion thing, you got to really want it. And I think another thing about being a PA is like you will want to not be that. So that hopefully will motivate you to, but it'll, you know, it could also make you very cynical and, you know, so yeah, I think that absolutely you gotta, I think LA is where it's at, and you have to find, productions where you can, you know, learn about the process and meet the people who are going to hopefully give you opportunities.
I mean, the other path is just apparently go to the Burbank High School show choir thing and just right. Scoop up the next Dove Cameron in a net and put it to work.
Well, you know, and today's PAs are probably tomorrow's executive producers.
Absolutely. Always be friends with the assistants, because what's the old line? Be careful the toes you step on the way up, because they might be connected.
Beep. So, Liv and Maddie season 3 is coming out on Netflix, I think, this week. Is that right?
Tonight?
Well, 19th. This is going to air next week, so right. by the time we're airing or up on the airwaves, it will have just come out, season 3, Netflix.
really proud of that season. That was a really, really special season.
And we initially thought it was going to be our final season until we got a nice Christmas present and got told we were going to do season four. So
yeah.
Season three is a beautiful season. And season four starts on Disney Channel when?
We don't know yet.
We can say fall,
well,
probably.
We know, but we're not allowed to say. I think we're allowed to say September.
I don't know.
I just did.
Probably September. Definitely fall on the Disney Channel. Thank you so much for
being
with us today.
Hopefully we didn't embarrass you.
Thanks for loaning your daughter to us for 4 years, too. It was really helpful.
It was my great pleasure. Thanks for listening to Hometown to Hollywood. If you like what you heard here, subscribe to this free podcast and leave a quick rating and review. A moment to click on a star rating really helps, and a minute to write a sentence-long review makes a real difference in the ranking for this podcast. Thank you so much for helping me. Do you want to know more about getting a young actor up and running in Hollywood? Buy my book, The Hollywood Parents Guide, on Amazon. And if you need specific help getting your career or your child's career up and running or to the next level, you can get a one-on-one consultation with me over Skype or in person in Los Angeles. Go to my website, hollywoodparentsguide.com, and click on the consultations page. Thanks, and see you next week.